It's been a real pleasure to be doing Raw, period. I really enjoy all the diverse things that we're touching on. My fear is that for you as a listener out there, that not doing the same thing every week might get a little bit annoying. So I'm going to try to do a little bit to let you know where we're going every time before we start, rather than just jumping right in immediately, even though jumping right in immediately is like where you get the good catch. So where we are going today is a little more wiscatology. That is, end of the world. We're talking end of the world with Pastor Brian Wolfmuller, and he and I, over the course of this series, which is going to go on for a while, are trying to engage the mindset of American Christianity in its heterodoxy. That is, the false ideas that people think are from the Bible about the end of the world. We want to engage that with what the Bible actually says about the end of the world. And we want to do this in a way that from start to finish, we are effectively creating a course or even a book, a statement about what real end-of-the-world theology, eschatology, from the Bible actually is. And we're doing this in part. I mean, why did we start this track? This was in order to make room for me to keep doing Revelation. I love doing Revelation, but it takes a lot more prep than Brian and I riffing on what we were taught at seminary, effectively, and what we've learned since. But, you know, what we were taught at the seminary is about the end of the world. So I do appreciate that you keep listening to all of this and the Is the Church Dying series as well. It's all part of keeping something going. And if you're only hanging around for Revelation, I apologize. It will come back. It always is going to come back. It's not going to go away. So, Brian, welcome back, though. Just hear your voice again. It's good to chat with you today. And
yeah, fantastic.
We're picking up at Matthew chapter 24, verse 29. And if I can try to recap, why are we here? We are here because this is a section of Scripture that clearly is dealing with the end of something and probably has implications for the end of the world. In fact, I would say by the time we get into the parables in 25, clearly is about the end of the world also. In fact, well, I really misspoke there, I suppose. The disciples think the end of the world is going to happen. They know it's going to happen, so they ask Jesus about it. But they confuse it with something else. They ask him two questions at the start of Matthew 24, which is, when is the temple going to be torn down? And what will be the signs of this end of the world, effectively? And Jesus is going to give two answers. But what happens for most Christians that read this text, including Lutherans are good about mostly distinguishing this, but sometimes we don't play by our own rules. We set some rules for like, oh no, here's how we're going to read the text. And then we just decide to forget it for a paragraph. And then we go on again. So we're trying to apply those rules to these two questions that Jesus answers first. What are going to be the signs of the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem? What's going to be involved around that? And then secondly, what are going to be the signs of the end of the world? And the big piece that you don't want to miss from what we talked about before, at least from my perspective, is that there's some technical terms that he's using or markers in the text to help you see his answers to the two questions. He talks about those days, those, plural, multiple days. And when you see that language, I believe it is a hat tip that he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. But then at verse 36 of chapter 24, which we hopefully will get to today, maybe, he turns and he doesn't talk about those days. There's no more plural anymore. He talks about that day, specific day, the day of the Lord, which if you want to dig more into that, we've talked about that in a previous episode, that language, the day of the Lord. So that he's gonna shift directions in his answer. Now, where Brian and I are still kind of working on, do we even agree on this, is that he holds that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Brian, but you hold that in the section leading up to verse 36, there are parts that are about the end of the world still, where I would contend that it's a hard break at 36, that everything up to verse 36 is temple destruction, including the sun turning to darkness, and we agreed on that a little bit, but now we're going to get into the Son of Man coming with the clouds stuff, and that at verse 36, now we're into the what comes next language. So, but if I'm understanding you right, you're still kind of willing to be convinced. I guess I'm willing to be convinced too, and that's sort of what we're doing a little bit as we dig through this.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think you set it up perfectly. And to understand the text rightly, this is what we need to do to understand that there's, you know, Jesus is answering these two questions, and that one of the things that then we can see is. That all the promises that Jesus gives, except for the promise of his second coming, All of those promises were fulfilled when Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD. So the thing we want to maintain with a great clarity is the imminence of the return of Jesus, that at any moment he could come back. We're not waiting for all of these end times prophecies to unroll, you know, for the temple to be rebuilt in Jerusalem or anything else. In fact, we don't want to see anything in the last 2,000 years or so as a fulfillment of biblical prophecy, like the reconstitution of Israel as a nation state. People love to see that as a fulfillment of biblical prophecy, but all of those things are striking at the imminency of Christ's return. So we're right on the same page there. It just is the question then, is the language that's, you know, end of the world language, is Jesus intending for us to understand it for the second coming, which we still wait for, or is it language that Jesus is using to describe the destruction of Jerusalem? And I think that is where we're still working through this.
Mm. But we were kind of on the same page up to verse 28, right? That this has all been destruction of Jerusalem stuff, the abomination of desolation, and we looked at the works of Josephus that you brought to bear on that in terms of the zealots taking over the temple and the killing of the priests and the letting in of the Idumeans? I can't remember now. Yep. Yeah, the Idumeans and all that, right? So up to this point, we're seeing that he's warning the Christians through the apostles that something's going to happen in the temple. And it's at that point, interesting though, did we talk about this? Verse 27, as the lightning comes from east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man, where the corpses there, the vultures will gather. That this is in many ways about him ascending into heaven, taking the power to make good on his promise to destroy the old covenant, to destroy the temple. I don't know. If you want to respond to that, you can. Do you want to respond to that?
Sure. And this is, I think, maybe one of the places where we want to press a little further, because this language of lightning flashing to the east and the west will be the similar language to that St. Paul will use in 1 Corinthians 15 to describe the resurrection at the end. In the twinkling of an eye kind of language. So my inclination is to take these verses 27 to 30 as a description of the last day, and I think your inclination is to take them as a description of the destruction of Jerusalem, right?
Although I think you just won me over for 27, but not for 29, and I'll have a textual reason for that. But I think you're right, kind of looking at it again, the context here, in response to people saying in those days, look, here is Jesus over here in the desert. Look, here is Jesus over here. Go find, or the Christ or the prophet over here. Go find them. He says that his coming, and I think you're right here, the 27 alone, from my perspective, stands out as the final day. When he comes on that day, it's going to be like, boom, right? It's going to happen. Everyone's going to see it. There's going to be no question about that whatsoever. So I think you got me there. And I'm glad to be gotten, by the way, on that. But then, so 29, though, here's the trick, right? It's immediately after the tribulation of those days. Right. So you don't just have those days, but you also have the immediately going on. And the tribulation of those days, we've agreed, I think, at this point, that that's the destruction of the temple. Right.
Yep.
OK.
Yep.
So then it's immediately. Well, what do you do with that? And to be fair, that word is kind of fluid in Mark and Matthew. It means right away, but not always in a weird sense. And so I don't know if that's where you would go, but I'm putting a lot of weight on that immediately. But then the language that comes next is certainly profound, different. Apocalyptic is kind of the classic way of describing this. The sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the power of the heavens will be shaken. That language is intense, and I can totally see why on first glance you're thinking like, yep, that's the end of the universe, because what else could it be? We did deal with this a little bit in a previous Revelation Unleashed section, because this language shows up in Revelation as well. And kind of the key to that, though, is that this language shows up before Revelation. It shows up before Matthew. It shows up in which one is it now? Is it Amos? No. Where's the locusts?
I think you have Joel and Amos both talking about
both that. Talking this way. It also talks. It shows up in Isaiah, dealing with the fall of Ephraim, for Pete's sake. I think at the end of I don't have the chapter in front of me, but we looked at all of this. That the point being, the language itself is intentionally over the top. In fact, the episode, you can look it up, is Holy Hyperbole. It's intentionally over the top. It is talking about the end of everything as you know it. That's true. But then it's applying, at least in those older texts, the end of everything as you know it to a very specific thing. Namely, again, the end of Ephraim being the end of Israel in many ways, in the case of the locusts coming, right, that this was going to be such a terrible plague that it was just going to change everything about the way that they know life is. I believe the fall of Babylon also gets some of this language at one point as well. So I'm not convinced that that language by itself is enough to say this is the end of the world yet.
Yeah.
Verse 30 is go ahead.
There's a distinction there too. Where I know that this language comes up especially is when Peter quotes Joel in his Pentecost sermon.
Yeah, yeah, which we covered way back. Yeah, do it again though.
Yep, and so he says, he says, look, these prophecies of the Spirit being poured out and the darkness covering the land, this is being fulfilled in your own speaking. So I think that's right to look at it that way. The distinction that I want to point out here in verse 30 is that the people will see two different things. They're going to see the sign of the Son of Man, and then they're going to see the Son of Man, both in the clouds and the sky. And I wonder if this might be then the bridge, so that at the destruction of Jerusalem, what you're seeing is the sign of the Son of Man, but then on the last day, you see the Son of Man himself.
Oh, that's an interesting way to look at that text. Okay. So, but here's then the challenge, right? So just like the sun turning to darkness and all this is language that doesn't show up here for the first time, the Son of Man coming with the clouds language also doesn't show up here for the first time. This is part of Daniel chapter 7. And what won me over way back, and I am willing to be convinced otherwise, is a very particular turn of phrase in Daniel chapter 7 about the coming of the Son of Man. Now, let's see, glancing, are you there? You had Daniel 7?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, Daniel 7:13 is where it is. But maybe, I don't know, you might want to back up because we have this vision of the Ancient of Days and the throne and the coronation of the Messiah in the heavenly throne room. I'm not sure how much you tell me how much text you want to take a look at here.
Well, I mean, I don't know much about the part before verse 9. Other than that, I know enough to say it probably has something to do with it. It certainly, at times, almost seems like or seems similar to Isaiah's vision. But then it's got a bear, which is not like Isaiah's vision. And then, and so it's maybe more about what the other visions that Daniel has dealing with the empires of the world and their coming and going, and I think that's probably more right. Is that correct?
Yep, that's right. And so I mean, all of Daniel's visions have that theme. Is that for some reason it was the peculiar the peculiar gift that the Lord was giving to the prophet Daniel to trace out history. More than any of the other prophets seem to speak, when they speak of the future, they speak of the immediate future and then also the Jesus.
Yeah,
Those are their two topics. But the Lord wants to kind of draw a line between the two for Daniel. And maybe it's because the Lord knows that pretty soon the prophetic mouth is going to be stopped with Malachi. So there's only another 100 years of prophets before that's silenced, so that people wouldn't think that the Lord has somehow just stopped acting in history. No, go and read Daniel and you can actually see it.
Right.
And so he traces you have the Babylonians, then you have the Medo-Persians, then you have the Greeks, then you have the Romans, and then you have the kingdom of the Messiah. So as that history is tracking, people would have that great comfort from Daniel. You know, it's like a prophetic summary. All the other prophets are into the weeds, but Daniel's going to give you the big picture.
This really hits it, though. I mean, he is so much like John, or John is so much like him, in that he's giving you, like you said, the big picture, what's going on behind history from God's point of view, and how God is seeing these nations that rise as, well, the way we would see animals, right? As part of his created order, they're certainly not all doing what he necessarily, you know, eternally wants them to do, and that they're broken or sinful, and the earthly power is pagan, right? But he's still turning it toward an end goal. And you get this bit about the horns on the fourth beast as well, that has the iron teeth, and it devours and breaks in pieces. And this is Rome, I think, which we should say this too, in case you don't know. There are, is it one or two other visions in Daniel? I know it's the image of the Nebuchadnezzar statue, right? With the gold, or dream, with the golden head and the clay feet. We have that one. I feel like there's another prophecy that deals with these same four empires, but in either case, the final one is Rome, and it has these horns, 10 horns, and there's a lot of hay made trying to say who these 10 emperors were, which this is where I really love the numerology of the Bible. 10 is a complete number. It's not necessarily literally 10, at least in my mind. It's the right number of emperors will exist in this Roman reality. He considers them, verse 8, and behold, there came upon among them another horn, a little one, before which three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn there were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. And, you know, I wish I had taken the time to go and see what Kyle and Dalich would say about that, because I bet you they have a decent guess, if there is a decent guess, as to who this is. I know the evangelicals are always trying to put that on something in the present, though, right? There's going to be some little horn showing up in running the UN and all that. So I don't have a ton of information, though, on it, other than to say that there is one among the Roman emperors who is sort of an epitome of evil, an epitome of paganism. And the point, I think, is not so much to figure out who he is as to see what happens next as being bigger than him. But what do you got for us on all that?
Yeah, that's it. Just like in the previous vision of the statue, the rock comes and destroys the statue. So now this little horn, which is speaking pompous things, you know, Revelation picks up the same language, is now going to be overwhelmed by the kingdom of the Messiah. And the contrast there is something that that we're supposed to grab a hold of, because as we live in this fallen world, you know, the little horn speaking pompous things is always, that's where our attention goes. And so Daniel wants to say, look, there is one greater who sits on the throne. And so even though we're, you know, persecuted and dragged this way and that way, our attention is drawn back to the reign of Christ.
Yeah. And so that you got this massive beast with 10 horns flailing everywhere, destroying everything. And among its horns is one that is still small in God's sight, but you know, it's yelling things about how you can't stop the beast. Well, behind these things and then behind these things and then behind these things, Daniel looks and he sees God the Father, I think, over the entire thing. But I don't think you get to see God the Father. So what does this mean? I don't know. Thrones were placed. Verse 9. And the Ancient of Days took his seat. Is it God the Father? Is it the Trinity? It's God. We know that, right? The description, though, is an awful lot like Jesus in Revelation chapter 1. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning fire. That's a hat tip to Ezekiel a little bit there in Ezekiel's vision. A stream of fire issued and came out before him, from before him. 1,000 thousands served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. It's a little bit like Revelation chapter 7 with the hosts of heaven, including you and me, dressed in white robes. The court sat in judgment and books were opened. That's going to show up in Revelation chapter 20, if I'm getting this right. So we got judgment day going on here, and the judge is God. I think the Son of God. I think that's where I'd put my chips. And then it's gonna go back to the horn again. So why don't you take your stab at that setup though?
Sure. No, it's great. I mean, so this throne, if we could give attention to this throne room of God, we would be doing really well. Just grabbing onto the biblical theology, because you know, normally when we imagine God kind of singularly by himself. You know, our picture of heaven is of a lone man sitting on a throne kind of thing. And this can you hear that snow falling? That's really something.
Was that snow?
Yeah. It's shifting on the roof somehow.
That's crazy. Yeah. I thought you were opening drawers. I'm like, what's he looking for?
Yeah. This picture of the throne room of God is this kind of the central vision of the scriptures.
That was crazy. I heard that too. Yeah. So I think what you're getting at, I know you're distracted by the amount of snow you're getting. How many inches have you guys had so far out there?
I think like 3 or 4 inches.
Three or four inches. You're talking about, though, this is what paradise conceived of, at least without the created order being restored with it, is, right? God is not lonely. God is not off by himself. God has his creatures and cares for them, and it is a state of joy. It is a state of service that is good. And yet, we're leading toward, though, right, the court sitting in judgment to deal with, right, with evil.
Yeah, and I think that there's 5 activities of that court. And if we could see, so we're so obsessed with how things are going on earth, but this is the vision of the prophets, is they stand in the courtroom of God and they see what's going on there. And these 5 things, at least, I've found. There's a conversation between the Father and Son and Spirit. That's the first thing. There's the court where our case is heard, and that's where we get our doctrine of justification. What's going to be the judgment rendered from that court? There's also petitions that are heard. So you picture the ancient kings hearing the petitions of the people and granting them, so our prayers end up before that court. There's worship that happens before the court. All the elders throw their thrones before the feet of God, and there's ascending that happens at that courtroom where the prophets are sent down to earth. So the activity of this place before the throne of God is the governing activity of the history of the world, and it's always the move of the prophets to draw our attention back up to that throne room. What's going on in the throne room is what matters. I mean, this is why in Revelation, you know, there's the beast and the prostitute and all this kind of nonsense, but then there's the Lamb on the throne, and that's the thing that matters. The same thing here in Daniel. All this stuff is happening in the world, but what's going on in the throne? And that throne room is where our life is hidden with God.
There is this, like, transcosmic, you know, beyond time thing too, right? This is the end of the world judgment, and yet I look and it's happening in the world to the beast, right? I look because of the sound of the great words the horn was speaking. As I looked, the beast was killed and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. It's going to be the dragon thrown into the Gehenna at the end of Revelation. I mean, it's all the same thing here. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. Okay, so it's not the end of the world then, right? It's like back and forth and back up. It's behind the world, which includes the end of the world. What does that mean, that their dominion was taken away and their lives are prolonged? Does it mean that we still have Greece? Well, we still got Italy. So it doesn't quite mean that. I'm not entirely sure myself. But again, what the setup here ultimately is, look, the world is doing one thing. Nasty beasts doing awful things. Life sucks. God is bigger than all of that, and he's going to sit in judgment on it, and he's going to destroy evil.
Right. That's right. And there's going to be this lag time, though, between the coronation and the visible celebration of that coronation. Mm. That's the time and the season, and it's what Hebrews talks about. You know, all things are under his feet, but we do not yet see all things under his feet. So the church lives in this kind of lag time between the coronation of the Messiah and the visible manifestation of that on the last day.
Yeah.
And we suffer that every day. I mean, this is very practical stuff, because this is how it is with the devil. You know, the devil is destroyed, but we do not yet see him destroyed or feel him destroyed. So we tend to think that the devil is loose and running around and he's ruling and reigning. In some sense, I mean, that's all we can experience, but we know by faith that the Son of Man came to destroy the works of the devil, that he's bound and cast into the pit and so forth. So we're in this kind of lag time between Jesus sitting on the throne and all eyes seeing Jesus sitting on the throne.
Right, the lag time, the overlapping of 2 different ages that were, in our minds, expecting. And the disciples questioned to Jesus on that mountain. They were expecting it to be a hard break, and instead we have kind of a blurring between the two as one is coming and the other is passing away. And the full coming has already occurred by faith, right? Or for faith, I should say, not because of faith, but on behalf of your faith, it has occurred in Jesus' resurrection. So verse 13 then is where we're trying to get to, that he see, but it's like it's a different vision though too. I saw in the night visions, right? And here then are the words that Jesus picks up on in Matthew 24, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a son of man, and he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him, and to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. Now, I think, at first blush, this is kind of an obvious section, right? That this is the ascension, you called it the coronation of Jesus of Nazareth as he approaches, strangely, himself in the mystery of the Trinity, and is given as a human, coming out of the humiliation of his suffering and of his, we also use that word humiliation to talk about the letting go of his powers as a man to some extent, the veiling of his powers in his life, ascending with humanity or with his humanity out of that and grabbing all authority in heaven and earth, you know, with his own brain, which is nuts to think about. And that's what I see, at least right here, the prophecy of. Yeah?
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly right. So this title, the Son of Man, is used in Daniel and Ezekiel. And in Ezekiel, it's the name that God has given to Ezekiel himself. And it's bound up to the humiliation of Ezekiel. It's used tons of times there. It's like 30 times in Ezekiel. But it's just used a few times over here in Daniel. And it's the opposite reference. It has to do with the divinity of Christ. Now, I think there's two ways to look at this, the Ancient of Days being the Father and the Son of Man being the Son, or, as you were hinting at, the Ancient of Days being the divine nature, the Holy Trinity, and the Son of Man being the incarnate Son, the Christ, the Messiah, who is receiving authority, who sits on the throne of God. And this is the point. When Jesus calls himself the Son of Man, I think he's referring to both titles, both Ezekiel and Daniel, but the one that's going to be that's going to bring the controversy is this use here. I saw the Son of Man coming on the clouds of great glory, because that is the name of, it's a name of God, and it's a claim to the divine nature. And Jesus will use it over and over. I mean, it, not only in Matthew 24, but also earlier Jesus used it. He quoted this verse in Matthew 16, and also later in his trial before the Sanhedrin, he quotes this verse in Matthew 26 and says, "You'll see the Son of Man coming." So Jesus is referencing this particular text to speak of how the Father has given judgment to the Son, and Jesus is fully God, even as he is fully man, and he will stand in the end judging the world. This is it's a theological claim. Now, you know, we're doing some timeline work. To what point in history does this refer? But the key thing is to realize that it's a theological truth being taught, that Jesus has all authority on heaven and on earth, and that he grabbed a hold of it, rightly, as you said, but in one way, he didn't grasp it, but rather it was given to him by the Father. It was a peaceful transition of power that the Father, you know, hands over all authority in heaven on earth to his own Son, died and risen and now come into this heavenly throne.
Well, and this is like one step in the process, too, because, you know, Paul implies there's going to come a time when Jesus hands it back. After all things. And that's kind of nuts to even think about that. He must rule until he puts all things under his feet. After that, he will hand all the things over to the power that he might be all in all. And all that, it is mysterious, right? We are getting glimpses of this reality. What you just said about the Son of Man language is pretty important, too. And I'm going to ruin one line in a great hymn for everyone who's listening, and I'm sorry to do this, but it's important. And you can still sing the hymn and let the hymn mean what it means, but it's wrong if you're going to try to make it biblical. And that is in the hymn Stricken, Smitten, and Afflicted, which is just a beautiful, beautiful passion hymn about Jesus' crucifixion. But it talks about him being Son of God and Son of Man, as if it's the title Son of Man is just about his humanity. And what you're getting at here is that not really. That isn't quite. It's not an incarnational term first, at least. Or maybe it is. Maybe it's incarnation of God as man, but it's not just that he was born of Mary, right? That's not all that it is.
It's not all. It's more than that. I mean, but it is at least that. I mean, and that's why we're so astonished, is that not only is a son of Adam and a son of Mary now sitting on the divine throne. So this is the astonishment of David in Psalm 8. What is man that you're mindful of him, and the Son of Man that you've considered him? That's Jesus there.
Yeah.
So Jesus takes his place lower than the angels, and then as exalted above the angels, for our sake. And now he has all authority. The authority that he had already as the divine Son of God, he now has it as a gift according to the persons of both his humanity and divinity. So the Christ is now... who is God and man is the one sitting on the throne. It's absolutely stunning.
There's another piece to this, too, that I wonder about, and this is, I don't know that I could prove this, but I think it's there. I think it's there in everything that you said about both what Son of Man means in Ezekiel, what it means in Daniel. there is an element of this in which Jesus is the firstborn of the next humanity. He's no longer Adam once he rises from the dead. He is the son of Adam, not just one individual, but another generation, not meaning like an era of people who die, but another manifestation, another edge, a new humanity altogether, right? A new Adam, a second Adam. And in this way, he is the son of mankind, and so are you, Christian, right? By being joined to this, you are part of the next mankind. And it's not man. It's not Adam. It's Jesus. It's the son of man. And maybe I didn't say that very well, but I think there's something to it, that there's the other humanity, the new humanity, is also wrapped up in this term.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the scriptures will normally call God our Father and Jesus our brother. Hmm. We're co-heirs with Christ and so forth. But Jesus is also called in a few places the Father. Like, for example, Wonderful Counselor, Everlasting Father,
right.
Mighty God. And I think this is what it's getting at. As the firstborn from the dead, he is now the head of the new creation, and we are the body that follows after.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you translate Adam as the way the word is used in Hebrew to refer to the earth, right? This man is he's the son of earth. He's the next creation. Oh, it's really cool. It's so loaded. The whole reason that we are here, though, is to wrestle with what Jesus is getting at. Then again, back as he finishes talking about the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, alludes to that his coming will be such that no one will be able to point to it. It's just going to happen. But says that, you know, you're going to have these signs of the end of the world. It's going to everything's going to be topsy and turvy after the destruction of the temple. I shouldn't say signs of the end of the world. Signs of a total transition, of a change unlike anything that anybody has ever imagined or experienced. And then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. And they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds with power and glory. So we went here to find this in Daniel 13, and I think the piece that's not there in Matthew that is here in Daniel that is so important is when it talks about coming with the clouds of heaven. How do we understand that term? And the assumption, at least so far as I always had it, the way that I think it leads the understanding of the text for most people, is that we don't read it through Daniel 7. We read it through Luke chapter 24 and or Acts chapter 1, when Jesus ascends and he's hidden by the clouds, and then the angels say, as you saw him go, so he will come. And so we come back to Matthew chapter 24, and we see this Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven, and we think, as he will come back, that is, that his coming with the clouds is a coming down. But if you read it through Daniel 7 first, it's the other way around. The coming with the clouds is not going down, it's the going up. And, you know, that is, I think then, that's how I then would read Matthew 24. In the immediate tribulation of those days, the sign of the Son of Man is the sign of his ascension with all power and with all glory. Which is that, what? First, that I would contend the destruction you just saw of the temple, the fulfillment of his words, right, that this is going to take place. And then what do you do with verse 31 in Matthew 24? And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds from one end of heaven to the other. Trumpet, I'll admit, the trumpet is definitely end of the world language. And angels could be the sweeping up of all mankind onto judgment day. But see, that word angels is a little more fluid in the scriptures, and I don't like that we always just translate it angels. It's messengers, right? Sending out his messengers to gather his elect, his church, from the four winds. That's from the edges of the earth. Well, this is also happening from the moment of the destruction of Jerusalem, when the Christians flee and the apostles finally end up in the nations proclaiming as they were told to do in Matthew 28. So I'm not convinced yet that this 31 isn't talking about the mission of the church in time and space from heaven's perspective. The fact that verse 32 goes back to talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, I think, is pretty important in me making this case, that he's just not done talking about first century yet. The fig tree, you got to learn the lesson of the fig tree. When its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know the summer is near. That is to say, you can tell when a tree is about to bloom, Right, and he uses a fig tree, by the way, as an image of Israel as well. So also, when you see all these things, you know that he is near. That is, these are signs you're going to see to tell you something's going to happen. Who is the he that is near? That's an important question. And where is he? At the very gates. The gates of what? And that's where I think we're back at Jerusalem. We're back at Caesar. We're back at Rome coming to do this. Verse 34. Which becomes an atheist's favorite thing if you say this is just about the end of the world. I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. I have heard it said the generation that's being referred to there is not the apostles in their lives, but is the Jewish people. Well, that's worth considering, I guess. It could also, based on what I just said a moment ago, be talking about the generation of all mankind, right? That humanity is not going to die until all these things take place. Verse 35 really isn't as much in contention. It's just the statement, right? Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. What I've said is going to come true. The question is, again, now how and where? And I think I have just, again, contended that what he has said so far, including the sign of the Son of Man in heaven and coming on the clouds, that is his ascension and that is the destruction of Jerusalem and then the sending of the church out to the earth. I'm more than happy to be convinced otherwise, though.
I'm going to throw in another verse that is very parallel to this. Earlier in Matthew, it's Matthew chapter 16, starting at verse 26, just for the conversation, I think it's important. It says, "For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his life? Or what will a man give in exchange for his life? For the Son of Man will come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then he will render to everyone according to his deeds. Most certainly, I tell you, there are some standing here who will in no way taste of death until they see the Son of Man coming to his kingdom."
Yeah, yeah. What does that mean?
So, it's the same. It means that whatever they mean the same thing.
Yeah.
I think because, Jesus, again, is going to reference the Son of Man in glory coming. What does that coming mean? But what does it mean that the generation won't end? That even more specifically, that some who are standing there are not going to die before they see the Son of Man come into his kingdom. And I think you're right that the trumpet, the Bible will sometimes speak of the trumpets, and then it'll give us the emphasis, the last trumpet. So when we hear the last trumpet, we know we're talking about the last day. That's, again, 1 Corinthians 15. But it seems like the Lord blows the trumpet every now and again, and we see the manifestation of that on earth when great destruction comes. Or, when the Lord certainly blew the trumpet and Jerusalem was destroyed. There's no question about that. And what's at least clear here is that both the death of Jesus, the resurrection of Jesus, and the ascension of Jesus, and the subsequent destruction of Jerusalem is understood as the coming of the kingdom.
Yeah.
I mean, when Daniel says that the kingdom will come and overthrow the other kingdoms, that when Jesus comes into his kingdom at the ascension and at Pentecost, true. But then the manifestation of that coming into his kingdom, we're still waiting for. We're still waiting to see it. We do not yet see all things put under his feet. We're waiting. Hebrews 2:4. So I don't know. In some ways, I see what you're getting at here. I always lean towards, and maybe this is my own fault, but I lean towards seeing these texts in Matthew 24 to be referring to the end, unless it's of necessity going to be the destruction of Jerusalem. So like all this generation won't pass away. That's speaking to the destruction of Jerusalem. But I think the next verse, 35 or 36 in Matthew 24, no one knows the day or the hour. No one knows of that day or the hour except the angels, my Father only. I just lean towards seeing these texts as pointing to the great last day when Jesus is manifest in his glory to judge the living and the dead.
Well, I think you kind of put your finger on the difference here. So I assume it's about the destruction of the temple unless I have a reason to believe it's about the end of the world, and you're assuming it's about the end of the world unless you have a reason to believe it's about the destruction of the temple. And for the most part, we line up like 93% of the verses, we end up lining up in the same spot. Which is really something, think about it that way. Obviously, I think 36, this is like the linchpin of my entire position, is that 36 is about the last day and that what comes after this is definitely about the last day, and that the parables which follow this are definitely about the last day, but with application to the Jews who are rejecting Jesus, you know, the wise virgins and all that is something that they need to hear in the moment that they're rejecting him. So the question then, I mean, bringing Matthew 16 to bear on this, I think I'm glad you did that, because it has to be. About the same kind of reality, the same kind of thing going on. What does it mean, though, that the Son of Man is going to come with his angels in the glory of the Father and repay each person according to what he has done? Now, I know the rules of language mean that you're supposed to take the near reference as the thing that a pronoun is referring to, normally, which is to say, when it says he will repay each person according to what he has done, who's the he? Normally the near referent is the each person. But I also am kind of convinced that it doesn't always have to work that way. So that it can also mean that he, Jesus, will repay each person according to what he, Jesus, has done. And that would kind of radically change the meaning of the verse. I think both things are true in our dogmatic understanding. The scriptures speak both ways. But again, I don't necessarily think this doesn't have to do with Jesus' death in the present. That is, they're seeing him die on the cross, seeing him coming into his kingdom, and that Jesus is in this moment repaying the world according to not what we do, but according to what he has done. And it really becomes a bit of a gospel verse. But you know, maybe I'm stretching there. I've also heard people try to rectify the some are standing here who will not taste death by saying, until they see the kingdom, by saying that the transfiguration is the next thing that happens in the text, that they see Jesus manifest his divinity and therefore it's fulfilled and you don't have to worry about it. I can acknowledge that that could be an answer, and if that makes your conscience feel good, go for it. It doesn't make my conscience feel good. I feel like it's a cop-out, and that the cross is the better answer, that is where we are seeing the kingdom come into place as John is sitting there looking up at Jesus, watching him crowned with thorns. That's the moment where the Son of Man has come into his kingdom. That's the moment when the darkness that has been prophesied on so many different levels actually physically happens in history, right? The sun turns black and all these things. Feel free to respond to that, but I also want to ask you, before we move out of this, verse 30, so where do you target the sign of the Son of Man? I mean, do you have a narrow target where you say, I think this is what that is? And I think you are still saying then that you would say they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven as being his return at the end, as basically being him going down, not going up, correct?
Yeah, I think that this is how I would take it. So back in Matthew 24:30, that the suffering of those days, the sun is darkened, the moon not gives it light. This is a description of the destruction of Jerusalem. The sign of the Son of Man appears in the sky. That would be the moon turning to blood and the darkness in the sky. So that when Jerusalem is being destroyed, they are able to recognize that as God's own judgment. The wrath of the sun being poured out on his own city. It's a stunning sort of thing.
It is stunning.
It's kind
yeah.
of a prophetic riddle, but yeah. you know, Jesus says to David, "Go establish my kingdom in Jerusalem," and David does it. And Jerusalem has all of these promises, and now the Lord says, "No more Jerusalem." And the result is the nations are mourning. I mean, because the nations are now Christian and they see this, you know, the wrath of God. So that the sign of the Son of Man would be the destruction of Jerusalem. And then the tribes of the earth is mourning. That would be a description of the time in which we are now. And then they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds would be the last day. Hmm. So that verse 30 moves from the destruction of Jerusalem to the age of the church to the second coming.
I really like what you did with the sign. I think I'm going to totally agree with you on that. And as particularly, so for the listener, just to rehash and follow, that we are saying that the sun being darkened is the destruction of Jerusalem itself. It's not that there was a dark sky over that day the way there was over Jesus on the cross. It's that Jerusalem being destroyed is a bigger deal in the cosmos than the sun going away. And that is therefore a sign for the heavens or to the heavens, even the angels themselves, dismayed. What on earth does this mean taking place, right? The Christians of the earth, the nations being brought into the glory of God through Jesus, see this thing and whoa, did we just join this thing, right? Boom, there it went. The shift that Brian and I have here is then, you know, where he's going to say then The Son of Man coming with the clouds is the last day. I'm going to say it's actually the ascension, right? And the power of the ascension, and then the sending of the angels, I'm going to say is the mission of the church. He's going to say it's the last day the angels gather into the judgment. Both things happen. Both things are true. And then I think we're pretty much in agreement with 32 and 33, right? That he, mm-hmm. the tree basically means, hey, you guys can see this stuff coming. So far as Jerusalem is concerned, 33 is once you see what I've told you is going to happen, you know to get out of the city because Rome's going to come against the gates of the city. And
yep.
The generation will not pass away. That is, you guys I'm talking to are going to see this happen.
Yep, that's exactly it. Yep. So that's great. And great to rehash. You know what I want to do is come back in 10 years and do this again and see if we can, how we're looking at the text. That'll be really interesting. But I think that's exactly right. So I see it going from Jerusalem to the judgment and then back to Jerusalem and into judgment, back and forth. In fact, each paragraph, in one way, Jesus works through the destruction of Jerusalem and ends at the end of the world. And you've got it divided into bigger chunks than I do.
Yeah, no, that is really, really interesting. What I love, though, what I said it before, but I say it's, I think it's amazing that like all but 6% of the words we're in agreement on, even though we're both hedging in totally different directions, and like it's such a small amount that we don't actually see. So it tells you really how clear the text is as a whole, right?
Yep.
Kind of moving toward a close, I think. Let's sort of do a preview for the next segment that day, because now we are definitely moving in a end of the world direction, and we've emphasized this before, and we're gonna keep emphasizing it because it's so different than the major Protestant Christian world believes. That as verse 36 says, concerning that day and hour, no one knows. No one knows what the time. No one knows it's coming in terms of when. We know it's coming in that, yes, he told us it's going to happen. Watch. But there are no signs of its coming. It will be like lightning when it strikes. Well, that's not fair, because lightning, when it strikes, generally you have some clouds coming beforehand. You're not even going to get the clouds, right? It is strictly going to be an unknown event. Not even the angels know. Not even the Son knows. And again, that's stellar right there. Only the Father knows this. And everything which comes after this is going to be explaining how little we'll be able to see it coming, the days of Noah. So let's get to that. But first, just, you know, your own, you know, point of emphasis on 36 there.
Yeah, we've been hitting on this verse all every time we've talked, because it's so important, this doctrine of the imminence of Christ's return.
Yeah.
So many people are waiting for all of these promises to be. In fact, I just heard this last week that someone, you know, the argument that for the rapture and all this sort of stuff is that Jesus hasn't given Jerusalem, or hasn't given the Jews, all the land that he promised them,
from the
great river to Mount Sinai or whatever. So that people, they love to look at the scriptures and see the promises that supposedly haven't been fulfilled. Now, I showed that person the three texts in Joshua where it says that they had all the land that the Lord had given them. I mean, that promise is so explicitly stated as fulfilled, but still they couldn't grab a hold of it. And this is the mind of most American Christianity. They want to see that God still has a lot of promises to keep. But this text is this great reminder that there are more promises, that the only thing left is the coming of Jesus, which we hope and pray will be today, right now, or very soon.
I think there's something really diabolical that is going on behind what you shared there. So what that dear Christian brother or sister who you were showing these three verses in the Bible to doesn't even realize has happened. But the system of theology in which she has put her trust, the order of hanging Bible verses together, has led her to deny the inerrancy of the Bible, has led her to deny the truthfulness of the book of Joshua, and say it can't mean what it says. Not in a way where I'm trying to read it in its context and find out what does it really say, but in a way where I actually just have to deny it's wrong. It says they had all the promises, or the land promises, fulfilled as much as God had promised them, but it doesn't mean that at all. Not even symbolically, it doesn't even mean that, right? It's just wrong. And you end up losing scripture itself. And that's terrifying to me.
Yep, that's right. All the promises of God are yes and amen in Christ. And especially when we think of the end times and the promises that the Lord is coming back quickly. All of these promises are yes and amen in Christ, which means that we can look towards the end of the world with this great confidence. Like Jesus says, when these things are coming, lift up your heads, because your redemption draws near. And the one who is coming back for us is the one, you know, the one who sits on the throne now, ruling and reigning, is the one who was crowned with thorns and was crucified for us. So as we look at the unfolding of history and finally the end of history, we do so with this great confidence. I mean, knowing that the one who will destroy all the enemies of the church is the Lamb of God, our Lamb, who takes away our sin. It's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. The following section is a big piece of what most people who believe in the rapture use, at least in terms of their language, particularly the phrase left behind. And if you're new to the Christianity game, maybe you don't know about the Left Behind series, but you know, you go 20 years back and it was all the rage. You got movies, you got books. I know as a young Lutheran in name Christian man, I was told I had to read these books, that they'd change the way I think about life and faith. And I read the first one, and yeah, it scared me a bit, but I don't know why I never read more. I think that's about the time I went and found the book to help me figure out what was going on with this stuff, and was like, started realizing how dangerous it was. But I want to give plenty of time to that, so we're going to hit that next time. But again, by way of preview, I think verse 37 and 38 can kind of lead us there, and then we'll come back to them again. So concerning that day, this is verse 36, nobody knows. It's going to be like something else, right? Verse 37, for as were the days of Noah. It's going to be like the days of Noah. What are those like? So will be the coming of the Son of Man. What were the days of Noah like? Well, he's going to tell you that. Verse 38, for as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day when Noah entered the ark. Now, I think that language, eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, is super loaded. It doesn't just mean that day the flood came, there were some weddings. It means that life was going on as if life was going to always go on, right? I'm going to give you in marriage because I'm not worried about the world ending tomorrow. I'm pretty sure you guys are going to have a good life. Go ahead. Go have a good life, kids. We're having a party now. We're going to eat and drink, right? This is an image of life being normal. And that is what was happening until the day when Noah entered the ark and they were unaware, right? They could not see any sign, which is the point. Day and hour, you don't see a sign coming. They were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away. So will be the coming of the Son of Man. Now, in your favor, by the way, the fact that he references the language coming of the Son of Man here as an end of the world thing, that's in favor of your argument from earlier. Though I hate to admit it.
Yeah, thank you. No, that's exactly. I mean, Peter picks up on this whole thing and he says, their scoffers come on the last day saying, where is the coming of the Son of Man? For things have proceeded like they were from the very beginning. And this is the kind of the logic of the sinful flesh. The church says, hey, Christ is coming. Jesus is coming back. And that should be a comfort to the Christians and a terror for to his foes, as we sing in the hymn. But everyone says, well, look, today is just a lot like yesterday. And that yesterday was a lot like the day before. So tomorrow is going to be a lot like today. And we marry, we eat, we drink, we live on, giving no thought to the end of all things. And so it's going to come, bam, like a flash, a twinkle of an eye, and everything that we're used to is over.
And it's, how much is this directly applicable to our life right now, right?
Oh, yeah, it is 100%. I mean, this is so that, I mean, we also eat and drink and we marry and we're given in marriage. That's fine because we don't know the day. So so we live as if the day is today and also as if the day is in 2,000 years. We don't know. That's the things that are in the Lord's hands. So we're living kind of with one foot is planted to the ground. You know, we're working and serving our neighbor and so forth, and the other foot is ready to go. You know, we're packed and ready at the same time.
Now that's applying it to the Christian. Look at the pagan world around us as Western civilization citizens right now. Think about the furor over environmentalism. Now I recycle, even though, from what I understand, it's not even that valuable in terms of the energy costs and whatnot. But I do it anyway because I feel like, you know, we're going to get there eventually. It'll make sense at some point. So I'm not against that. But the furor I'm talking about is the talking as if we're going to be here forever. And so we better take care of this planet, right? As if we don't somehow manage what's going on here in a perfect way, humanity will be destroyed. And I'm not saying that believing that Jesus is going to come before that is an excuse to do a bad job with stewardship of the creation. For Pete's sake, you were given to care for the garden. Care for the garden. That's not the point. The point is how enwrapped in the belief that things are going to continue going on as they have been going on with no change, how stuck in that the pagan mind is, the world power is. We believe that America has to survive for the good of the rights of humanity, because if we don't, we're, you know, it's going to be horrible forever and ever and ever, right? Everything we do is wrapped up in this believing tomorrow is going to come. And the Christian, like you said, it's one foot, we all got to live. No, and one foot has to believe tomorrow probably will come. But we have a whole nother foot saying, then again, maybe it won't. And I'm okay with that one too. Even being okay with that. How many Christians are okay with the end of the world being like before they get to listen to this episode? That'd be crazy.
Yeah, I know. It'd be great. I mean, and one of the things, I mean, I remember times past where I would meditate on the coming of Jesus, and I say, oh, I hope it doesn't happen until, you know, whatever, until I have some children, or until I have a home of my own, or until I see Australia.
Dude, I'll do you one better. As a young man, it was until I have sex. That was awful. Seriously, what an idiot!
I never thought about that myself.
You're real pious.
Now, this is the point: is if we have that sort of idea, it stands. That is judged by the hope of the resurrection, because what it means is that we have not fully, or we have not even partially grasped the glory that awaits for us, which no mind can conceive, no tongue can confess. I mean, the things that the Lord has in mind for us in the resurrection, when death gives way, when temptation is no more, when we see the Lord face to face, these things are so glorious that that any sort of hesitancy for the Lord's coming is a hesitancy to be crucified. In the glory of that day.
Yeah, to have the present belief in what happiness is give way to what it really is. So I'm gonna go ahead and close with this next thought, but I think you're spot on. We'll pick up with, again, Matthew chapter 24 and Noah's days and the world to come the next time that we chat with Brian. But it reminds me of another story, not as bad as the young man who wanted copulation before the world would end and he could go to heaven and have a good time. I mean, as if, oh, it's just so backwards to think that way. But my kids caught me in this same kind of thinking, not quite as... Well, it was just as pagan, but not as anti-Ten Commandments, maybe. I don't know. I don't know. It's First Commandment. Man, I'm digging myself a hole here. But in either case, my kids caught me in this, and I think it's hilarious. Because we have worked really hard to help my children believe not just that they're going to die and be at rest with Jesus in heaven, but that there's a world coming which is going to be better than this one. And especially as young people growing up in the present darkness of our evil age, where who knows what's going to come of our nation or Western civilization or anything that, we want them to have the solid rock of what's going to come. So we tell them about how the new creation is going to be a creation, how there's going to be animals there, and if they want to ride a lion, they can. And I'd tell the story sometimes about how I hope to grow avocados. I want a little avocado farm right on the road up to whatever the New Jerusalem is like. So as people go to evening prayer to worship Jesus and receive his gifts in the evening, I give them guacamole on the road. And I don't care if that's really what it is or not, but the idea is it's like it's going to be like that. It's going to be at hands on. So then they believe this. Thank God my children believe this. And one day we were as a family going somewhere and we were going to get some food while we were out. And I believe we're going to go to Buffalo Wild Wings. And somehow my kids got in a conversation about the end of the world, and or maybe it was about something that they didn't like. I don't remember what caused it. Somehow one of them said, well, Father, I just hope that Jesus then comes back soon. And I said, that's great. If he could just wait 35 to 40 minutes, that'd be better. And my wife leans over and says to me, that's just because you believe there won't be barbecue wings in heaven. And it was like, oh my goodness, she caught me. She caught me in my arrogance of denying, or how do I say this? In my arrogance in believing that whatever I have here somehow is better than there. So that whether it is the barbecue wings in heaven will actually be there and they'll be better because they won't have any corn syrup and they'll be good for you, right? Or whatever's there won't be barbecue wings. It'll just be way better. We are so trapped in the present, right? And that's why I'm telling the story, why I think it's hilarious, is because it shows it doesn't matter how much you know this. Your flesh always still doesn't believe it, and you always need to hear it again to be brought to repentance of it. So that you remember that you don't just stand with both feet in this present evil age, yeah? But that you have one foot in the life of the world to come. One foot's already in your grave through baptism. The other foot seated in heaven with Jesus, who's reigning all things to make sure you get there with him on that last great day in which barbecue chicken wings, oh, God willing.
Was that worth a dollar? What about five? If so, Pastor Fisk and his family would love to have it, in part to pay for technology and paperwork to keep Rev Fisk Raw going, and in part to just enjoy a night out together. Pledging $1.25 on Patreon, only $5 a month, lets the worker know his labor is appreciated. And if you're a true fan, you can give even more. You can find the link to Patreon in the show notes, and check out the other giving levels there, including advertising your product, your family, or your congregation on Rev Fisk Raw. Lock and load, then rock on.